Coming up on Tech News Today, get Scroogled, find the ungooglable, and we'll stop changing the internet for 2 years, apparently. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, November 28th, 2012. Tech News Today is brought to you by Pond5, the world's stock media marketplace. If you're a media maker looking for video, photos, illustrations, music, sound effects, After Effects templates, or 3D models, check out Pond5. And for an exclusive 50 free stock media downloads, go to pond5.com/TNT. And by the new Squarespace. Squarespace introduces a new content management system, making it faster and easier to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. Plus more than 50 new features, including mobile responsive designs. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TNT11. And by audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Maya Zakhtar.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And this is the show where we keep you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world, starting each time with the top 10 stories of the day in the newsrooms. I hate it when hobos fight. On a totally unrelated note, Nokia has asked courts in the U.S., U.K., and Canada to block sales of RIM's BlackBerry phones. The request comes 2 months after an arbitration ruling by the Stockholm Chamber of Commerce in Sweden regarding licensing terms for patents relating to the use of WLAN connections to the internet.
Hobo fight. That's cold. So speaking of non-hobos, is Windows 8 a failure or isn't it? Let's look at some numbers. Microsoft has sold 4 million Windows 8 upgrades in the first 3 days of availability, but within a month, the company claims to have sold up to 40 million Windows 8 licenses. Well, that sounds good, right? Desktop OS data from web metrics firm NetApplications shows that Windows 8 only accounts for about 1.2% of all desktop-based web traffic. To compare, Windows 7 had reached 4% in its first 3 weeks.
Skype's updated its iOS app, so now users can log in using their Outlook.com, Hotmail, or Messenger accounts. Once you've logged in, you can merge your accounts and chat with friends on those services from the Skype app. If your iDevice has a Retina display, Skype has one more thing. Animated emoticons. Really?
Really? All right. UK student Richard O'Dwyer has reached a deal to avoid extradition from the UK to the US over alleged copyright violations. O'Dwyer ran a website called TV Shack, which hosted links that often went to sources of unauthorized copies of films. BBC reports the High Court was told O'Dwyer had signed a, quote, deferred prosecution agreement, which would require him to pay a small sum of compensation after a brief trip to the US within the next couple weeks.
Let's talk more about Microsoft, shall we? Microsoft has pinpointed the problem that was causing some Windows Phone 8 devices to spontaneously reboot, which is usually not something that anybody wants. It says it hopes to push an OTA software fix next month. The company didn't identify what the cause was and won't say whether the issue affects all Windows Phone 8 devices or just certain models.
Facebook is subjecting its proposed policy changes to an official vote among its users. The newest changes would impact the data collection policy and would also remove the ability of users to vote on future proposed changes. So if you want to be able to vote on Facebook stuff in the future, go vote in the present.
There you go. Your vote counts, at least for now. Apple fired Richard Williamson yesterday. We talked about this at the end of the show. He was the manager who oversaw the Apple Maps team. Sources told Bloomberg that Senior Vice President Eddie Q made the decision. Q is reportedly seeking advice from outside mapping technology experts and working with TomTom to fix navigation data it shares with Apple.
U.S. Representative Daryl Issa has introduced a piece of legislation that would prevent politicians from passing laws or regulations that might drastically change the internet over the next 2 calendar years. So think SOPA, PIPA, ACTA, CISPA. Issa is against these types of bills and has taken to Reddit in the past to explain bad tech policy. In fact, his new bill is called the Internet American Moratorium Act, or IAMA for short. Sound familiar? Yeah. Same acronym as Reddit's popular Ask Me Anything series. In fact, I said we'll be answering questions on Reddit about this bill at 7:30 a.m. Pacific tomorrow.
Actually, today. He's up there answering them right now.
Oh, holy. Holy crap.
Holy
answer in
IAMA. Representatives of internet companies and the music industry are testifying before the U.S. Congress today regarding internet radio royalties. Right now, AM and FM radio pay no royalties to artists, only to songwriters. Satellite radio pays 8% of revenue to artists, and internet radio pays a market rate royalty that often exceeds 50% of revenue. Music industry claims internet radio companies want to gut the royalties that artists rely on.
How about some more Microsoft? Even more. The latest rumors say that Microsoft is currently working on a new system for how it handles Windows and Windows Phone releases, and it's codenamed Blue. Blue would include an annual update cycle to the OS and a new Windows SDK that would push developers to make apps for Blue, as Microsoft would no longer accept apps created for Windows 8. Blue would hit mid-2013.
Am I Blue? I hope. Maybe I will be someday when I update. Let's take a break and thank our sponsor for today's show, Pond5, the world's stock media marketplace. Let me tell you, folks, if you're working in any kind of creative enterprise, they've got something that can help you out. Instead of just going out on the internet and troll, you know, if you're making a collage for home use, you probably don't need Pond5. But if you're making something for public consumption, maybe something you want to sell, something you want to do on Indiegogo or put up as a podcast that you sell advertising against, you want to make sure that you've got royalty-free images that you have the rights to use. That's what Pond5 gives you. Photos, vector illustrations, music tracks, something that's often hard to find in a licensed form anyway. Sound effects, customizable motion graphic templates. So you don't have to be a sophisticated editor. You can make some good-looking stuff here. 3D models, all kinds of stuff. In fact, the collection's growing all the time. Get in there and search around. You can find those fancy helicopter shots that they use at the beginning of movies. You can find stock photographs of pretty much anything you can think of. Think of something, Ayaz.
I'm going to think of airplanes.
Airplanes. That's easy. Jason's going to search for airplanes. You're going to find millions. Well, pretty close, actually. 18,000 stock video
and propeller planes.
Yeah, stock
jets.
Photos. And if you're a creator, you can actually you can upload the stuff that you create. If you're out there taking these shots, upload your photos. You get 50% royalties for each and every sale, and you have control over the pricing. So if you're a media maker or artist, you absolutely should check out Pond5. Take your creativity to the next level or upload your own content and put it to work at the world's most artist-friendly marketplace for stock media. And the special offer this month, 50 free stock media downloads if you go to pond5.com/TNT. You can make a whole movie with that kind of stuff. 50 free downloads at pond5.com/TNT. Go take a look. Check it out. Let us know what you think and show your support for Tech News Today. We thank Pond5 for their sponsorship. All right, welcome into the show, Mr. Aaron Newcomb of Floss, right here on the Twit Network.
Also Floss Weekly fame.
Many other things.
Yeah, sure. All about Android, This Week in Google, and now TNT.
Yeah, welcome. Yay. Good to have you, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks for sticking around.
Yeah, I always sit over in the other set over there watching you guys do your thing, and so it's good to be on the other side of the fence.
I miss our days of me coming into the cottage and waiting for you to get out.
Right, yeah, I would always be in your chair, and you'd be like, okay, Aaron, get out of there, come on.
It's nice to have the room, though. Well, let's start off talking. All we ever talk about on the show, people criticize us all the time, is Microsoft. But we're going to start off with a Microsoft story, right, Sarah?
Oh, yeah, but this is a really good one. You guys are going to love it. Microsoft has invented a term for when you get duped by Google into buying something from Google Shopping, even though it's just a paid ad. It's not actually an organic search result. You know what it's called when that happens to you?
I do. Do you want me to say it? I mean, I don't know, Sarah. Oh.
Scroogled. You just got scroogled. Did you buy something from Google Shopping? See what they did there? Screwed and Googled? Scroogled.
Oh, two words into one. I didn't get that.
Like Scrooge? Because he's so skin-flinty?
That's how I read it.
I guess you could, maybe. I don't know.
That's not what they meant.
Screwed probably makes more sense.
Hey,
the Scroogled. If you go to scroogled.com, it's great. You know, you sort of got this sort of upset gal going, oh, I've been scroogled. And it's very kind of dramatic. It says right in front and center on the page, in the beginning, Google preached, don't be evil. But that changed on May 31st, 2012. That's when Google Shopping announced a new initiative. Simply put, all of their shopping results are now paid ads. This is, of course, a change Google did make. They moved to a model earlier this year where merchants either pay per click or per transaction to be included in Google Shopping. We've talked about whether this is makes Google Shopping irrelevant compared to something like Amazon in the past. But Microsoft is saying, listen, you know, it's just a bunch of targeted ads. You're an unsuspecting customer. You think you're getting search results. Google calls these product listing ads, and truly great search. We say that when you limit choices and rank them by payment, consumers get scroogled. For an honest search result, try Bing. And they even,
by the way, we're Microsoft. Great. Try Bing.
It's hysterical. They actually have on the page, they include a sort of a timeline of how Google has gone evil. They include a line from Google's founder letter that was written back in 2004 that said, "We do not accept payment for search results or for inclusion or more frequent updating." Basically, Microsoft's, you know, making the claim that Google's just, they're not acting like the way that you might have historically thought that they would act. It's a whole different beast now. And they also invite you to share your story about being duped or scroogled at Bing's Facebook page. There are a few stories there, probably not as many as Microsoft would have hoped by now, but I just gotta love this. It's so petty. It's so lame. I love the term scroogled. I was trying to get the whole, you know, the troops rallied up on Twitter this morning. Nobody thinks it's as funny as me, apparently, but I don't know. I mean, do you guys think that this sort of thing is effective, worth more than just a chuckle?
You know, I have to say, I am with Microsoft on the basis of the criticism, and I've mentioned this before on the show, the idea that a search engine is only showing you the results or preferring the results that are paid for is what was always one of the criticisms I had of the way that shopper.com was run when I worked at CNET. And there is something called pricewatch.com that's better about that sort of thing, and I would expect better of Google. On the same point, kind of lowering yourself into using Scroogle, which was a fine way to do SSL search that wouldn't get logged back in the day.
Yes.
At Scroogle.com. It starts to lose me a little bit. I don't know. Aaron, how do you feel?
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's Microsoft being Microsoft, basically. I mean, I can understand what they're going after, right? Because they're trying to build audience. They're trying to get more viewers, more eyeballs. And so, you know, they need to do something. So they play on people's fears. They, you know, every company does this. But I just think it's funny the way that they – it's just – I don't know. To me, it's just funny. It's just laughable. And I like the new stuff that they're doing with the Bing It On stuff, which is also mentioned in this article. You know, Bing It On, like, who came up with this? Like, I don't understand who's coming up with these things.
They have some punny people over there at Microsoft marketing.
I mean, their internet service division is not exactly making a ton of money. They got to go after the leader. I mean, you remember the Gmail man thing that came out last year? I mean, Microsoft is doing whatever it takes to get the leg up on Google when it comes to the web. And the funny thing is, if you go to the Bing's shopping section, it does say in the small gray box, payment is not a factor used to rank search results in Bing.
Which is great. That's good.
It's good to know that. But the thing
Where is the shopping section?
You have to click more and then go into shopping. So it's not very easy to find.
Yeah, you might want to fix that.
Regardless of whether the word is funny, Scroogle, the thing is the Google product search is a piece of garbage anyway. The fact that Microsoft could just say, look, our product results are better. Forget the fact that they're taking money. It's that those results are just miserable so far.
Right.
So if they could change that, maybe then it'd be much more interesting.
Yep.
Actually, I have to say the Bing shopping search engine is very well laid out. Once you find it, it's got a nice little price drill down on the left. You can go by store, you can go by brand, all that sort of thing. And if these are not paid results, as they say they're not, this is a very useful thing. I tell you what I do, though. I go to Amazon when I want to find stuff like this.
Oh, yeah. Is the Amazon Prime hook still, or is it just the fact
that Amazon search results will show up, or Amazon products will show up in Bing search results, too.
But not in Google, because Amazon
not in Google, though. Yeah. Exactly.
All right. Let's continue talking about Google, because Google wants you to be able to find the un-Googleable.
Yeah,
is that
a
word?
That's the head. Well, at least it's a word in a headline that the technology.
Googled, un-Googleable.
All kinds of crazy words.
It's a Googleplex of Google words today. So MIT Technology Review had an inside look at Google's future plans, and it's called the Daily Information Needs Study. Now, the MIT Technology Review editor, Tim Simonite, is a part of a Google experiment.
I'm sensitive to that because my brother's name is Tim, and I got called that all my life.
MIT Technology Review editor Tom Simonite, my apologies to all Toms out there and Tims, is now part of a Google experiment where he gets called by Google 8 random times a day and is asked a simple question. What did you want to know recently? Now, Google's conducting this experiment with about 150 people, and they're trying to figure out what kind of data people want. So this is a quote from John Wiley, lead user experience designer for Google Search. Maybe these users are asking a friend, or they have to look up a manual to put together the IKEA furniture. So they're trying to get a whole bunch of weird data that you probably wouldn't even think to go to Google about. Simon Knight says he's answered the questions by saying, how long is the line in the grocery store? He's had questions about cooking a meal, reading a novel. It's things that come up from reading a book.
How to read a novel?
Well, while he's reading a novel. He wouldn't go to Google for, because it's you got to bring out a computer. And mm-hmm. He doesn't want to disrupt that experience.
So what's all this about?
Wiley's comments suggest that Google's going to start using a ton of devices to answer questions before you ask them. So think Google now, mm-hmm. but it's taking advantage of every device that Google makes, like Google Glasses, Google Android devices, anything that they have.
The Nexus Q.
If it ever comes out. I guess my real question is there a downside of getting answers before you ask them? So like if I'm running towards the airport, should I be getting these notifications right away? Or do you guys have privacy concerns?
I don't have privacy concerns. I mean, I think that there's ways to lock that down, right? So that information isn't shared with other people I might not want it shared with. As long as they're doing it anonymously, I think it's fine. Google Now has certainly been, I think Google Now, did you cover this? Was one of the top picks of the year, the new innovations of the year. Sorry, I don't have it up. I'll have to bring up Google Plus later and figure it out. But it was picked by some organization as something really good. How's that? but basically, you know, Google Now is one of those things where I actually use it. I mean, it really does help knowing how long it's going to take me to get home or to work.
Popular science.
Things like that. Yeah. I mean, it really – popular science. Thank you. It really does help. So I think that becoming more predictive, which it seems like this is what they're really all about, right, is trying to predict those things that are – that you wouldn't normally think of, or you wouldn't normally type into a search engine, could be really, really useful for a lot of people. I'm not worried about the privacy part as long as it's, you know, my information is anonymized as the information gets sent back and forth to Google or wherever.
The privacy issue for me is separate from them doing stuff with it, right? It's how do you collect it? And that's what Aaron's talking about, mm-hmm. Do I have control of the information? Do I know what information you're collecting and how you're keeping it and what you're doing with it? And do I have control of all of that? That's the privacy implication. As long as that's all taken care of, and Google's done good things with their transparency reports and everything to say, here's what we got on you and here's what we're doing with it, then this is great. Mm-hmm. You know, as long as I'm in control of that side of it, having them make the best use of what I let them have to predictively say, like, hey, we see you're going to the airport, your flight's on time, and that sort of thing is awesome. The question is, how much do I have to live in the Google universe to make this work well? I don't have an Android phone. I have an iOS phone. I do have a Nexus 7 tablet that I use at home. So Google Now works for me, but it doesn't work as well as it would if I had an Android phone that was walking around with me all the time.
Well, is that the issue, though, or is it that? I mean, because they could do the same thing on the iPhone, right? If Apple gave them access to GPS locations and all that stuff, right? I mean, it's really just a software application. So it could happen on any device, really, as long as the device manufacturer gives you those keys to the kingdom, so to speak.
Sarah, do you think you'll ever be able to check Google for the line, how long a line is at the grocery store? I mean, that sounds a little local.
I think the airport example makes a lot more sense to me. I mean, the local grocery store, it's like, well, I mean, what if you don't live that close to a grocery store? Some of the stuff seems like, hey, that would be pretty cool.
Trader Joe's parking lot, Sarah. What if they could tell you which Trader Joe's had the shortest line to get into the parking
lot? That's valuable information right there. Mm.
But I have two Trader Joe's sort of equidistant to me. And by the time I get there, the story might be different. I don't, some of the stuff I think is a little bit like, hey, look what we can do just because we can do it. Then again, it's going to be helpful to some people. And so I think that is moving forward.
All right. Let's talk about moving forward without doing anything. Congressman Daryl Issa, we mentioned, is proposing the Internet American Moratorium Act, seeking your input on a bill to ban new regulations or burdens on the Internet for 2 years. He's actually doing an AMA right now on Reddit. A lot of people are asking him, hey, I know you oppose SOPA. Why did you support CISPA? Or why haven't you done more about this and that? It is an AMA, so it's branching off into other areas. But essentially, the big debate is, should we create a 2-year moratorium on any new laws, rules, or regulations governing the Internet? ICE's position, from what I've seen him say, is we can still regulate the Internet for 2 years. What this does is says, let's have one session of Congress from the point that this is passed where we get Congress to get up to speed on issues and not take knee-jerk reactions. So we continue to regulate. The executive branch can still do its thing. The FCC can still do guidances. But we don't pass any new laws. We don't just throw a bunch of SOPAs, CISPAs, PIPAs out there. We take a moment to step back. The criticism seemed to be, well, that's all well and good, but what if we need something in those 2 years? And the other one is, what if Congress doesn't take your 2 years to actually learn anything? People are very doubtful that that's going to happen. Aaron, what do you think? Is this a good idea or a bad idea?
Well, I think in general it's a good idea. I'm kind of along with what you just said. This could hurt things if something really bad is going on and there needs to be some sort of regulation. But I think in general people are of the opinion that the internet can kind of handle itself for the most part. And that it should be able to handle itself for the most part. In fact, Google just, you know, announced the Free the Internet campaign or whatever they're calling it to try to combat these types of regulations. So I think this is a good thing. The other thing is, you know, Congress probably needs a couple years to just get up to speed on what things mean as far as, you know, technology-wise. They don't seem to be on top of some of the issues that were brought up with SOPA and PIPA. So it would be nice, actually to have this kind of cooling down period, kind of keep the some of the organizations that would like to influence their decisions at bay a little bit. So I think overall it would be a good idea.
And one of the interesting things about it is Daryl Issa is taken to Project Madison, which is a place where people can sort of wiki-like help draft the legislation and add things to it. If they're like, well, it should have an out for if there's an emergency and we need to pass a regulation, or it should have this or that. And taking to Reddit to do these AMAs is also, he's looking for feedback. He's like, I don't want everyone to agree with me. I want people to challenge this. Sarah, given the fact that he's willing to listen, do you think that something constructive could come out of this?
Come out of talking to people on Reddit?
And talking to people on Reddit, going on Project Madison, but overall saying, let's start with a bill that puts a moratorium on regulation of the internet for 2 years.
In general, I think this is a good idea, just because we've all seen what happens when a bill starts kind of skyrocketing to becoming law and people go, wait a second, you're not even reading this right. Hold everything. I mean, we had quite an internet outrage about this very thing that applied to a few bills. I also feel like, well, if you put a stop to everything for about 2 years and that's designed to help everyone get up to speed, let's all understand what we might be proposing. And then at the end of the 2 years, everybody's a little bit more on the same page and are making good decisions. But the internet and the technology behind all of this is constantly evolving as well. So it's kind of like you almost need a commitment from the people who are introducing bills and have the power to push them through to stay on top of this for a lot longer. I do think this is a good first step.
I think what's interesting about it is, and I was against it when I first read about the headline this morning, but the more I read ICE's justifications, the more I realized what he's up to is providing a new way to draft legislation. And by doing it on the internet, he's doing it in the place where it can work best with something like Project Madison, and saying for 2 years, we're not going to stop regulating the internet. We're actually going to continue to regulate the internet the way it is regulated right now. We're just not going to change the way we regulate the internet. And we're going to take some time to maybe draft legislation. Maybe IS's plan is to draft legislation for 2 years using things like Reddit and Project Madison.
Trying to get studies to put together like a reasoned opinion.
So at the end of the 2 years, you get some better stuff.
I'm looking at the actual text of it. I'm actually hoping he'd push this exemption as the actual law. It says here, or the bill, it says that the Homeland Security or the president, for purposes of addressing this threat, it's to combat the existential threat to the internet. So that's when regulations happen, when the internet itself is threatened to cease to exist. That's the point where we should be regulating at all, not bothering with these private industry concerns that maybe could be worked out better in the free market. Why not just leave the internet alone? And if there's an emergency when it comes to the existence, then we deal with it. But it's definitely a really interesting idea. Although that 2 year period of people are going to get educated in 2 years, it's kind of like when you have you have till April 15th to file your taxes. Like, right. Who does that? Like in January? Like, I don't know if anybody's really going to take advantage of the 2 year time.
That. Yeah. Patterson in the chat room points out it also gives lobbyists time to attend more fundraising breakfasts. And that's important. Breakfast is the most important meal of the day, even for lobbyists. Let's take a quick break and thank our sponsor, Squarespace.com. Faster and easier than ever to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. I use it for lots of things. We use it for Sword and Laser. We just had a new Sword and Laser go up yesterday. It's so easy. We get done recording our show for the audio podcast. I go into Squarespace. I just throw in the show notes. It's now drag and drop with Squarespace 6, so it's easy to make a page that looks good. I can update our calendar with all the book releases and everything. And then I'm on my way. Squarespace has great templates, too. It's easy to make something that looks good. In fact, it's better than ever. You don't have to know. I mean, they give you access to under the hood if you need to. You don't have to know HTML5, CSS3, JavaScript, or JSON. Or if you're like me and you do kind of know them, but you're just tired, you don't want to deal with them, you don't have to. With Squarespace, you got great support, and they have the best mobile experience going. New templates with mobile-ready, responsive designs. That means your site automatically restructures to look great on any brand, smartphone, tablet, or computer. And when you add an image to your site, it's automatically created in 7 different versions. So it loads fast, it loads right, and it looks professionally designed no matter what screen anybody's using when they look at your website. And it's reliable. Squarespace is famous for its ability to keep websites up on the internet. So go take a gander at it. Go to squarespace.com. You can try it out absolutely free. You don't need to know anything from us. You don't need to give them any credit card information. Just sign up for a free account and try building your website. If you do decide to purchase it, use the offer code TNT11 and get 10% off your first purchase on new Squarespace accounts. And don't forget about free domain registration with annual plan subscriptions. That's squarespace.com. Show your support for Tech News Today and try out a great website host. Use that offer code TNT11 to get 10% off your first purchase. And we thank Squarespace for their continuing support of Tech News Today. Got some new numbers in on the tablet market, Sarah, and things are starting to finally get squeezed for Apple, it looks like.
Yeah, in fact, a lot of you Android folks are going to love this, and a lot of you Apple folks will say, but these are ship numbers, not sale numbers. But here are the latest figures from ABI Research. The iPad has a 55% share of all shipments, tablet shipments, during the past quarter. Android is at 44%. That's not a huge difference. In fact, it is Apple's slimmest lead ever and a 14% loss from the quarter before this one. And you think about it, okay, well, if Android continues with growth like this, could even overtake the iPad for tablet share by next year. Some of you might say, well, of course, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, Android includes all sorts of popular models, the Nexus 7, for example. Asus said back in October that their sales were approaching 1 million per month. You've got all of the Kindle models. We don't exactly know how many numbers those are because Amazon doesn't like to talk about it, but all signs point to pretty good. And back in 2011, the story was a little bit different. In fact, a Gartner study suggested that Apple would keep 47% of the market through 2015. And even then, Android would only have about 38%. Because, of course, even a year ago, it still sort of remained to be seen what other OSs might do to the market share of both iOS and Android. WebOS, not so great. RIM's Playbook,
not even existing.
Not so great.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, it's big growth for Android, which is good. But again, it's a bit of an apples and oranges, sorry, pardon the comparison, just because you have a lot of different Android tablets that do a lot of different things. So you're appealing to just a lot of different people and variety of price points. And then you've got the iPad. Now, ABI, this is the research company that put these latest figures out, says they don't really expect the iPad mini to give Apple much of a boost as far as market share goes. The trend has started. The tide has shifted, or turned, rather. And that's kind of it. But I wanted to ask you guys, I mean, how much does it really matter? Obviously, Android smartphones took over from iOS in market share by a big margin. And it, you know, it's not as if Apple is hurting as far as sales and profits go.
I mean, this is, it looks like the tablets are kind of mimicking the way the phones went. The mm-hmm. thing is, when the first Android phones came out, kind of clunky, not as polished. And as the years went on, the devices got better and the software got better. And so the competition really started to heat up. When the first Android tablets came out, kind of an ugly story. It was honeycomb, wasn't truly a version of Android for the tablet, and now it's getting refined and more refined. And the price points are dropping to the point where people are like, oh, I know what a tablet is, and that one's $249. As that keeps changing and progressing, I think that I don't know if the Mini is going to stave off any competition, but just Android's getting better as this goes along.
Yeah, in fact, I just answered this. Well, I answered from my own perspective this morning on Google Plus. Somebody asked me, should I get an iPad Mini or should I get a Nexus 7? I'm like, well, Nexus 7, duh. I'm an Android guy. What am I going to say? But seriously, what you just said is right. I mean the price point's coming down. The software's getting better. That was also a problem, not just the OS itself, Honeycomb, but the available apps for tablets, right, have been a problem. But that's getting better and better also. So, you know, I think people are starting to look at this and say, yeah, why should I spend an extra $50, $100, whatever the price difference is when everything I need is right here on an Android tablet?
But will you be able to continue to buy those Android tablets? I mean, there's constantly the patent battles. They're trying to keep them off the shelves.
Yeah, oh, yeah. You know, on that front, if you thought that Apple and Samsung were just kind of going to make some peace, I don't know, shake some hands. Dutch court just banned sales of certain Samsung Galaxy products that infringe on an Apple patent. It's very specific. It describes a way to scroll through a photo gallery using a touchscreen. And I love the reason that Samsung kind of lost this one. They had lost a case over this exact same patent in 2011, but then said, we've made changes, so our software no longer infringes. Okay, everything's good. But then the court said, you didn't bring us any evidence. You're just telling us that you made changes, and that's not good enough. So one of the three judges in the case, named Peter Block, said, I'm going to grant the ban because Samsung refused to sign a declaration of abstinence committing to not infringing the patent. So you didn't bring us any evidence and you didn't sign the abstinence agreement. So no.
You had to sign that agreement to get into Greenville College when I was a kid.
The abstinence agreement.
Stop. It's always about patents.
No, seriously.
Colleges and patents.
That was exactly
stop.
What it was called. Let's talk about something that Mary Jo Foley broke back in August, and now The Verge has got some more information about it. The mythical Windows Blue, is it mythical?
Back in August, the rumors were that Blue was the next version of Windows, which would be Windows 9, but it didn't seem to be exactly the successor. It seemed like some kind of low-cost alternative to Windows. Now The Verge has more details as to what Blue is. It would be an approach, a standardizing approach to both Windows and Windows Phone. The report at The Verge is a little light on Windows Phone, but it talks a bit about Windows. Blue would be the next operating system that everyone is going to install. Microsoft wants. So this is what they want. Microsoft wants you to get this. It's supposed to be really low cost, maybe even free. So you could get this next operating system for free, potentially. Once Blue is released, the Windows SDK gets updated. It'll support the new releases. And Microsoft's going to stop accepting apps for Windows 8. Now, before everyone freaks out. For the store.
Right.
Before people freak out, Windows 8 apps will still run on Blue. It's just Blue apps won't run on Windows 8, probably. So they're just going to basically push developers, hopefully, towards their new Blue, I guess, architecture or app structure. I'm not even sure what to call it. Microsoft would keep the Windows 8 name for the future. This would happen mid-2013, some UI changes. And the whole reason for this is so that Microsoft can have annual updates. They want to really update the cycle for Windows. Right now, I think it's like 3 to 4 years. Talking about an annual upgrade cycle. Now, we've seen quick upgrade cycles from Apple. Ubuntu has, I think, like twice a year. Is this something Microsoft needs to do to stay in the race? Do they need to have a yearly update to Windows? Or should they just stick to the 3 to 4 year product cycle?
If this ends up being true, and it looks pretty credible to me, it's a matter of semantics. What it seems like Microsoft is doing is they're beefing up their service packs. They're mm-hmm. going to provide more into their service pack. And at the same time, they're trying to really deliver on the promise of that Metro tiled interface of being the one place where everything runs. Remember that RT, Windows RT, doesn't have desktop apps because they want you to write apps for Windows RT that will also work on Windows 8. And what this would do is add Windows Phone into the mix as well, so that the Windows Store says, you buy the app once, you own it on any device that runs Windows, without losing the ability to have independent applications that run on the desktop in Windows 8. Now, that's why I would think maybe the first one's free. Windows Blue comes out in the summer. It's like a service pack, but it delivers more, and they make it available for free. But then they've got to figure out a pricing structure, whether it's subscription or a pay-per-update or something going forward, because I can see them rolling into no longer releasing big Windows updates, but just kind of doing this on a more regular basis.
Is this a shift in the way that Microsoft gets its revenue? I mean, they get revenue from all kinds of sources, right? But, I mean, they've always charged for their operating system. I'm just wondering, are they now saying, you know what, we think we're in the future, we're going to get more revenue from the app market space than we are from OS sales. So let's just throw out the OS for free or nearly for free because we want to keep people engaged, keep developers engaged, writing apps for
That's why
stuff.
I can't believe it would stay free because they make so much money on Windows.
Yeah.
You know, site licenses, enterprise,
especially corporate. Yeah.
Sarah, do you think with an annual upgrade cycle that we wouldn't see giant shifts in the UI like we saw with Windows 7 to 8? We have big change.
Yeah, they don't have enough time on a yearly cycle. I mean, how much can you I guess you could screw something up if you really wanted to. But yeah, I mean, a yearly cycle, you're going to see more incremental changes, which, I don't know. So you kind of got that issue with if you take iOS, for example, you know, sometimes the latest version of iOS will roll out and people go, I don't know. Some stuff is better, but it's not really a huge difference. And then on the other side of it, you've got something like Windows 8 that rolls out and it's like, holy crap, everything's so different. Oh my gosh, what are they doing? Because it's just so jarring that not everybody's going to be excited about it. So sure, a yearly cycle, I think, would probably keep the pandemonium down a little bit.
And one of the things, too, if it was a yearly cycle that was a subscription service, is they're able to get that money that they need. But then they can roll out things without the big expectations, because the other problem with Windows 8 is, like, on the one hand, it looks totally different when you're in that tiled interface. On the other hand, if you're using it like me and you're in the desktop all the time, you almost forget you upgraded.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not apparent all the time that much has changed.
I wonder if with the subscription-based system, would users have different expectations? Because, I mean, with phones and other devices, you kind of go, yeah, it's not going to work. Microsoft has been doing legacy support for such a long time. Like, look, your subscription doesn't cover this, okay? This is something that's beyond the scope of this. You go, oh, okay, that's fine. I understand that, because that's the way subscriptions work. But when you have software upgrades, people get really angry when it doesn't work on their older
machines. Microsoft Office is going to pave the way for that, mm-hmm. It looks like.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's finish up with the congressional testimony going on right now over the music licensing. We talked about it in the news fuse. Essentially, the battle is, on the one side, companies like Pandora are saying, you're taking way too much of our revenue. We can barely hang on. Nobody's starting new businesses to do internet radio because of the punitive royalties. And on the other side, you have the industry getting their artists riled up. People like Roger Waters, people like Natalie Cole are out there signing letters and performing. There were songwriters performing on Capitol Hill that if this is changed, if the royalty rate is reduced for internet radio, that it's going to take money out of their pockets. Peter Kafka at All Things Deep pointed to testimony from David Pakman. He's the former head of eMusic. If you remember, eMusic sort of paved the way for DRM-free MP3s way back in the day. He is now an entrepreneur in energy. He has abandoned digital music, and he says the complications and conditions of the state of music licensing make it so that it's just not profitable to get into this industry. He says, while our industry is used to failure, the failure rate of digital music companies is among the highest of any industry we have evaluated, and this is solely due to the overburdensome royalty requirements imposed upon digital music licenses by record companies under both voluntary and compulsory rate structures. The compulsory royalty rates imposed upon internet radio companies render them non-investable businesses from the perspective of many VCs. Now, this is
That's a pretty defeatist attitude, isn't it?
Well, he's basically saying, I'm a venture capitalist. I'm an expert. I'm not on either side of this. I'm telling you, Congress, I don't put money in these things anymore because the system is set up where I can't make money on them anymore.
But the whole point of, you know, what Pandora and certain legislation is for is to change the state of digital music. So somebody like Pakman doesn't have to say, well, you know, it's just not profitable, so it's not worth it for me to invest in.
Well, and that's essentially what Pakman is pointing to. He's saying, look, you need to change this rate structure if you want people to create new internet music businesses. Otherwise, it's going to continue to be bad. Now, on the other hand, Aaron, artists have a point, right? If you cut the rates, they're already under the gun. They're making less money all the time. If you cut the rates of internet radio, doesn't that take more money out of their pocket?
Yeah, but there's other ways to make money, right? Do more concerts, sell some stuff. I mean, I don't know. I just think that the whole structure, this is one little piece of a bigger problem with the music industry. And this is one little piece of it. I mean, I frankly, until Pandora started, because they send emails. If you're a Pandora listener, you know they send you lots of Tim Westergren. Is that how you say his name? Anyway, he sends lots of emails out about this because it's important for their business. And, you know, quite frankly, until he started sending those out, I always thought it was the opposite. I always figured, oh, it's internet radio, so they must be paying a special internet license where it's like half the cost of radio, right? And it turns out it's completely opposite. It just does not seem right. I'm not a music artist, so I, you know, maybe that would, my opinion would change if I was a music artist, but I really don't think, I think there's other ways that artists need to make money besides getting royalties from their contracts with the music industry.
But even if artists say, listen, don't cut our royalties because we're artists and this is what we do for a living and that's not fair, Pandora isn't like artists should get less money.
Right.
Pandora and other internet radio services are saying, we pay 64% of our revenue, satellite pays 8%, and terrestrial radio pays 0. Shouldn't it just be more even? Why are we bearing the brunt of so much of the revenue that we're bringing in just because we're a newer technology?
And the other side of it, Pandora is also saying, we would be making more money for you if we had a lower royalty rate, because more businesses would be doing this and we would be more successful at getting people to use our products. But we can't afford to spread the word and get more people to consume music in legal ways.
And these rates have squeezed out a bunch of smaller competitors. I remember when internet radio started, there was like, even like every site had a radio station, including like Marvel Comics. I had no idea why, but they did. And so the thing is, as these rates were so expensive, these things started dying off. And Pandora survived for like 10 years. I don't know how they managed to do it, but they did that. But there are other alternatives out there. There's Spotify. They've managed to come out of like pretty much nowhere, have a $3 billion valuation, all this kind of... It's not for the mom and pop thing anymore, it seems like. I don't know why you would expect it to be that way, because it's the internet. Anybody can do it. But it looks like if you're a major player, maybe you can deal with the pricing structure. But then again, the record industry is like, yeah, the pricing structure is great. We get to get 50% of the cut.
The pricing structure is not going to work out very well if they run everybody out of business, though. And that's what Pandora has just been barely avoiding.
But that's the thing. Like, are they running everybody out of business, or the people who can figure it out, like Microsoft's Xbox Live Music or Pandora?
Those are downloads. That's different than internet radio. How many internet radio companies do you know? Not Spotify's, not RDO's.
Not RDO or the Spotify radio functions or the Xbox.
iHeartRadio.
Pandora. Last.fm.
Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
That's me. There you go.
But so here's a question. I don't know if you guys know this, maybe the chat room knows. Do people pay? So do radio stations pay? Because like most radio stations do have a streaming thing on their site. You can click on it and listen to it. So do they pay for that, or are they like grandfathered in to?
I believe I think there's a different set of regulations that they have to pay something, but it's different than the normal internet radio. I could be wrong about that.
Okay. So, and then the last thing I'll say about this is that, you know, from my personal experience, I have bought more stuff, more music, like bought albums, right, listening to Pandora than I ever have listening to the radio. So I discover new music that way. I don't discover new music.
That's why AM/FM doesn't pay artist royalties, so, because they say, we're going to sell you a bunch of records. But apparently that doesn't work.
I think it's the opposite now. Yeah. I think it's a complete shift.
Well, maybe radio needs to have a button that says, you know, buy one click. I mean, that's the thing with Pandora, internet. Right. You can actually just buy the song directly.
That's the thing that kills me the most is like some of these artists saying, don't cut our revenues. It's like, I really think that they are misguided in saying that internet radio is somehow taking anything from them. That's where I get all of my music discovery. That's where all of my recommendations come from. I don't use Pandora exclusively. I use internet subscription services as well. But it is how I am still discovering and paying for music, honestly.
I mean, that right there is kind of indicative of just the state of the music industry right now. Nobody wants to give anything because it's so radically different now than it was even 10 years ago that somebody needs to give something, but nobody wants to be the one to give it, to kind of trust that moving into that next phase will actually work on the other side. You know,
and
it's a panic situation.
You have what they did with DRM happening in internet radio. You drag it out for years until you finally give in and then allow businesses to be made out of it. Mm-hmm. And that's why we see successful stores cropping up, because they made it easier.
Everyone's holding onto their belts because they don't want to be caught with their pants down, basically.
Yes, exactly.
But put some pants on.
You have one of those Sansa belt things. You're going to be fine. Let's move on to the randomizer. Real quickly, this one caught my eye on a gadget today. The Phoenix Project allows you to run WebOS as a Nexus S app. So if you're just reminiscing for the days of WebOS, or maybe you're an enthusiast who loves the current open source WebOS project, and you want an easy way to live in that world sometimes, kind of reminds me of when BOS made the desktop launcher, mm-hmm. where you could try out BOS right from your desktop back in the day.
Yep.
I'm looking at this, just makes me sad. It's like, here was an operating system that actually had some really interesting things that Google took wholesale because they took Matthias Duarte. So here it is again, if you want it.
Yeah.
It's too bad that didn't work out.
Yeah. All right, let's thank our other sponsor for today's show, Audible. This episode brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider of audiobooks with over 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of books. You can get novels, you can get sci-fi novels, you can get romance novels, you can get nonfiction, all kinds of interesting things written by top authors, science, politics, and it's all available right there at Audible.com for listeners of this show. Go to audiblepodcast.com/TNT. Right now, you can get an absolutely free book. If you're like, I've been listening to Twit for a long time. I've been an Audible subscriber for even longer. Give this URL to somebody else. Audiblepodcast.com/TNT allows you to get a free audiobook. You can get The Hobbit. If you're like, you know what? I want to read The Hobbit before the movie comes out. It's coming out December 14th. Go get it. Unabridged. Narrated by Rob Inglis right there on audible.com, absolutely free, or any book of your choice. Go to audiblepodcast.com/TNT, and we thank them for their support of Tech News Today. Do it now while Sarah tells you the most important event on our calendar all year.
This is an annual event that is eagerly awaited throughout the tech universe, and that is Leo Laporte's birthday.
He'll be 21 again.
21 years
so
young, Tom.
Be sure again? Tomorrow.
That's tomorrow.
The second straight year.
I'm gonna make a big fuss on iPad today,
which he
doesn't appreciate. But
you'll
hey,
know how to.
It's not about
Leo
him,
Laporte,
right?
Is that what your know-how is gonna be? How to have a birthday?
Exactly. That's what we're doing.
How to do a show on your birthday?
Anyway, we know a lot of people listen or watch this show maybe a little later in the day, so we're gonna give you the heads up. Wish Leo a happy birthday tomorrow, and a big happy birthday to him from all of us as well. Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
We got a message from Jason. Hey, TNT crew. Just wanted to comment about Google requiring Google Plus accounts for leaving comments on apps in the Play Store. From a developer's side, this is great news. Google implemented commenting on reviews not too long ago, but it was only for top developers. Many users only leave reviews when they're having issues and don't try to contact the developer through email or other means. With this new implementation, developers can finally contact these people to try and resolve their issues.
Good point.
Or, even like an inline commenting system where you could reply as a developer. You know, that's something that sometimes hotels will do within TripAdvisor, mm-hmm. Or Yelp. And that can be really helpful.
Or track them down and make them retract the review.
Yeah, Amazon does this pretty effectively, right? If you've ever browsed Amazon reviews, someone has a problem, this didn't work. I mean, when a supplier gets involved and says, hey, we'll ship you a new product right away because you had this problem, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to buy that. And this has been something that developers have been asking for a long time. I was at a Samsung developers conference not too long ago, and the top question was, please give us a way to interact with users when they say they're having a problem with our apps. And so that's true. This is one aspect of that is really good for developers. So.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you, Jason. And thank you, Aaron.
Yeah, absolutely.
For joining us today. Let folks know where else they can find your insights and wisdom.
Wisdom. Wow. I don't know where you're going to find that. But if you want to find out what I'm talking about and what I'm thinking about, which may not always be wise, you can find me on Google+. That's the best place to get in contact with me. I'm Aaron Newcomb there. You can find out about all kinds of cool things that I'm covering or thinking about, from Android to Linux to making stuff to Twitch shows, which I do occasionally. You can also follow me here on Twit. I do Floss Weekly. I do All About Android occasionally with Jason over there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And This Week in Google. And so, yeah, just any way you want to get in touch with me. The best way to have a conversation, if you want to say happy birthday, like most people did yesterday, thank you very much, is to follow me, add me to your circles on Google+.
Wait, it was your birthday yesterday, too?
My birthday was yesterday.
So you're a Leo as well?
Yes.
Because Leo's a Leo.
Leo's a Leo. Actually, I'm a Sagittarius.
Oh, you're
though.
A Sagittarius?
Yeah, there's a,
is he
a Sagittarius? I'm at the
a
line somewhere. Oh, yeah, I don't know where that line is. I guess
Well, happy birthday.
Yeah,
happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for hanging around after Floss. Really
Absolutely.
Appreciate
this was fun. I'm glad we finally got a chance to do it.
Cool. You can find our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com, if you want to submit stories. We look at that every day to figure out what kind of stories we're going to be talking about in the show. And, of course, you can find us online, twit.tv/TNT. You can email us. Our email address is tnt@twit.tv. And you can give us a call. Leave us a voicemail. voicemail. It's 260-TNT-SHOW. If the rain doesn't wash us away, we'll see you tomorrow.
There you go. Were you? Oh, you were. Were you in there? Oh, you were kind of in the preview monitor, anyway. So you were
a little video DJ going on over there.